Hey, good morning. It's still morning. I have no relationships to disclose. So the work that I'm going to talk about today is part of the community engagement portfolio of the Center on Society and Health, which is an academic research center at Virginia Commonwealth University. We look at policy connections, targeted communication, scholarly research, and bringing that together with community engagement in order to inform various academic and non-academic sectors. And this work is part of an ongoing community academic research partnership, which started in 2011 with residents of subsidized housing communities in Richmond's East End, called Engaging Richmond. And there's a map of the neighborhood that we work with and some of our Engaging Richmond team members, which are academic partners, community residents, and service providers working together to prioritize research questions, collect data, analyze data, and disseminate the results. Through this ongoing partnership, our community residents brought to us a challenge that they were experiencing in planning for a redevelopment process in one of the subsidized housing communities. So they came to our meetings and they said, we hear that our community is going to be redeveloped. We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know what's going on. We don't know how to get good quality information, and we're really worried about what's going to happen in our community. So we use that relationship to try to build an opportunity to better understand some of the issues that were facing the population and prioritize initiatives to best serve the population through the process. So the reason that it's important is that subsidized housing community residents often have very poor health outcomes. They face kind of concurrent challenges in economic situations, education, chronic disease, early mortality. This population in particular has a life expectancy 19 years lower than the highest life expectancy in our city, so it's a very low life expectancy area. And, you know, research evidence is pretty solid that these populations are vulnerable, and they're vulnerable during the redevelopment and relocation process. So our goals were really to engage various stakeholders to proactively plan for positive health impacts during the redevelopment process, to examine evidence-based practices from other communities that have been through similar processes, engage local service providers and other stakeholders who have an understanding of how these programs might be implemented, and to increase transparency throughout the process, because we saw that it was very difficult for people to get good quality information. How many of you have worked with housing development groups in the past? Okay. And governmental organizations that are involved with economic and community development? So I don't know if you've experienced this, but we experienced that the language that they speak is very difficult for residents to understand. So residents were really trying to participate in the process and understand the process, and the language they were using really wasn't very transparent. So that was a big goal of this process, was to try to increase that transparency. There are some partner organizations. I represent the Center on Society and Health. We were responsible for stakeholder facilitation, kind of documenting and doing the community engagement. We partnered with the Urban Institute, Metropolitan Housing, and Community Policy Center. So they're the national evaluator for some of the HUD awards looking at housing redevelopment, and have a really good body of expertise in evidence-based practices. So they provided the evidence-based practices on various topics throughout the process. We also partnered with our Mayor's Office of Community Wealth Building, which is a really exciting and innovative office in the city of Richmond. We were really excited to work with them. They really helped with sustainability of our efforts and connection to policymakers. And we also worked with our local Promise Neighborhood Initiative. Are you all familiar with Promise Neighborhoods? So we have an unfunded Promise Neighborhood, but it's a very active coalition, and they have subcommittees and action teams on various issues that impact the population. So they actually hosted many of our stakeholder convening initiatives and partnered with us as we worked with community residents. So our first engagement initiative was, we called it the Informed Neighbors Corps, and these were residents of the Creighton Court community, which is a public housing community, about 504 housing units, who were interested in getting more involved with the redevelopment process. And We recruited for the Informed Neighbors in a number of ways. We kind of put flyers up. We did door-to-door distribution. We extended personal invitations to people that we knew were really interested, people who were consistently showing up at other community meetings, or people who were kind of leaders in their community already were invited personally. And then we had information sessions, invited them to come out, and those who wanted to stay with the process kind of stuck with it. So they self-selected a little bit. Here's some of the trainings that we did with the Informed Neighbors just to kind of increase their capacity to be involved with the process, because we really found that they weren't ready to show up in this space and engage in dialogue, because it's very complex. Housing redevelopment is very complex. Economic redevelopment is very complex. There were many things that were extremely hard for me to understand, even as somebody coming from an academic background. So we did things like leadership training, negotiation and advocacy skills, kind of basics on HUD redevelopment processes. There was a lot of addressing misconceptions about what was going on and how it was going to happen. So many meetings over time to kind of build that capacity. So we had about 20 community participants, over 40 meetings, 75 hours of training. Through that process, the Informed Neighbors used the information that they gained to create informational bulletins to distribute to their neighbors. They did door-to-door campaigns to kind of raise awareness among their neighbors about what was going on in the redevelopment process, because, as I said, the process was very opaque. There were lots of misconceptions. And they did neighbor-to-neighbor meetings, which were hosted by the residents themselves rather than the developers. They're often meetings hosted by the developers for the planning process, but they were not resident-focused, and they were really not very well facilitated. So it was a big challenge to get the residents involved. In addition to the residential engagement, we also engaged area service providers to review evidence-based practices based on the priorities that the residents brought forth of their primary concerns about the housing redevelopment process. And we met monthly, we reviewed evidence-based practices and discussed feasibility for local implementation. We did that in partnership with the Informed Neighbors Corps. So through the process of those meetings, we set several priorities. We did that through facilitated discussion. We reviewed a whole bunch of data, lots of maps, things that kind of showed the areas of highest concern. And we also looked at common challenges that can occur during the process of housing redevelopment and relocation. So here are the priorities that came to the top through that process. And these are priorities that both residents and service providers really easily agreed upon. So the first one is communication and transparency. As I've mentioned several times, it's hard to get good quality information. Mental health and substance abuse was the top priority for the resident partners. They felt that if the underlying mental health and substance abuse challenges of community residents were not addressed, that they would not be adequately prepared to engage in the process of redevelopment. All of the paperwork that would be required, different requirements for employment, those sorts of things would be a big challenge for them. Individual level and community level trauma was a really big issue. We have a lot of violence, community level violence, violence within the family and within the home, that people felt that there was a strong relationship between mental health, substance abuse, and community level trauma that they would really like to have looked at. Wraparound services, kind of the cohesiveness of the overall service environment. Affordable and supportive housing, specifically for individuals that were suffering from mental health problems and substance abuse. Asthma is a really big issue. Apparently, Richmond is the asthma capital of the United States. So we have a lot of asthma, specifically in our subsidized housing communities. Our asthma emergency room hospitalization rates for that community are through the roof, very expensive. Violence prevention and positive youth development. This is a list of the partners that we engaged throughout the process, either in our ongoing meetings or in larger community forums where we continue to set priorities and goals. And this is a list of the evidence-based practices that we reviewed related to the priorities that were identified. Through that process, we created tailored action plans for each of the priorities that were identified. And on each of these action plans, you can see that there's some kind of markation for whether they're planned, currently in progress, or completed. So for each of these, I'm just going to talk about a little bit of the successes that we've had through the process. For communication and transparency, we have within each of our subsidized housing communities a resource center, a community-based resource center, where housing advocates are placed to help residents through the process of navigating housing-related issues. There's also health advocates that are co-located. So those health advocates have agreed to discuss current lease concerns with the residents, because in order for them to move into the new mixed-income housing communities, they must be lease compliant. Often residents do not understand what it means to be lease compliant, and they have barriers that others might not understand for lease compliance. So they really need to know what lease compliance means, how do they get there, and have services to help them reach that goal. Another issue was just to make sure that we had all of the information about ongoing meetings available to those that were not able to attend, or those that wanted to be more involved with the process but meeting times didn't work for them. For some reason, nobody was documenting any of the meetings, and that information was not available to the public. So we made good progress in getting that available both on a website and in community-based locations like resource centers, libraries, areas where residents would be likely to attend. And the big win on this was, in order to address the misconceptions about the housing redevelopment process, the CEO of our housing authority, which is the Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority, agreed to attend regular meetings with community residents. So they host the meetings, and RRHA shows up and answers any of the questions that the residents have about what's going on through the process. So that was really exciting for us to be able to get the president, the CEO of the housing authority, to agree to do that. They're also regularly answering questions that residents have in writing and providing that back through leaflets and flyers delivered to residents. Asthma was one of the next areas that we prioritized. So we have an ongoing grant to look at prioritizing asthma programs. Our resource centers are connecting residents to existing resources, and we are planning to seek a 5-year grant to do an asthma intervention, which is looking at housing, family-based and school-based asthma-related services. Mental health and substance abuse. Some of the wins in this area have just been some mental health first aid training that we got funded to complete to increase general awareness about some of the mental health issues that face the community. Again, referral to local services was a big issue. We found that often there were resources that were available that people were not aware of, and just having service providers together in the same room to talk about the services that were available often enabled them to better connect to the existing services. Affordable housing, I think the big win on this one was that the developer and the Office of Economic Development really didn't realize the need for permanent supportive housing as part of the redevelopment plan. In this process of engaging residents and service providers, they recognized that need, and they committed to applying for permanent supportive housing as part of the new housing population. Violence prevention. It's a big issue. One of the things that we're planning to do is apply for a CDC grant on positive youth development, and there's ongoing connection through the resource centers. Trauma-affected communities. One really exciting thing is just to kind of raise awareness about the way that individuals are impacted by trauma, and we've been doing this both with service providers and residents through our Richmond Promise Neighborhood Coalition. So we've hosted now 4 trainings on trauma 101 to help people understand the way that populations are impacted by trauma. We're also very actively involved with planning for a citywide trauma symposium where residents will have a voice in the process of explaining the way that they and their communities are impacted by the trauma that they face. And we're looking at opportunities to apply for replicating a model that our stakeholders really liked called trauma-informed community building, where it's a trauma-informed lens for community development, which kind of takes the stakeholder and resident voice into consideration throughout the process and recognizes that the process of redevelopment can be re-traumatizing for populations that have experienced trauma. Wraparound services is another area that was of great importance. This probably is our biggest win. So we had representatives from the Urban Institute come down and meet with the CEO of the Housing Authority, the Director of Economic Development, several other key stakeholders to highlight the importance of wraparound services. So other redevelopment processes have really shown that if residents are not prepared and supported during the process of relocation, that often it can exacerbate some of the conditions that they face. And we know that our residents are not prepared based on the data that we've collected and based on what we hear from them, that they need good connection to cohesive services in order to be prepared for the process. So The City Office of Economic Development and the Mayor's Office of Community Wealth Building have committed funds to provide wraparound services to the first 30 families that are going to be relocated. This is directly as a result of our process. We're really excited about that. And they have committed to engaging the residents throughout the process of selecting the families and selecting and designing the services to be delivered. So this is just kind of an overview of the timeline of our work. Again, we started back in 2011-2012. We were approached by our community residents. We started our Informed Neighbors Core first, which was our engagement of the public housing community, and then started engaging our stakeholders in the service provider community. We did not have funding to continue our resident engagement, and that's where our partners at the Office of Community Wealth Building came in, and they have committed sustained funding. So it's just really important to have multiple stakeholders at the table that share a common goal to plan for sustainability. So just a few lessons learned. We found that using a public health lens as a way to start the discussion around redevelopment was a little bit more politically neutral and often was very supportive of having positive dialogue. Shared investment from all stakeholders was very important to committing to action throughout the process. So in our work, we are really not responsible for following through on most of the actions that we recommend. We rely on shared goals through our stakeholders and commitment from other stakeholder organizations to follow through on the actions. And we found that that's worked pretty well because people are developing shared goals and shared values throughout the engagement process. The direct communication between residents and service providers was really, really key. I was very surprised about how excited the service providers were to hear directly from the residents about what they thought was most important. It was one of those moments where you see everybody kind of lean in and they're really excited about what they hear. That person-to-person communication was just really key, and being able to provide a forum for that was really important. We saw a culture shift over time, especially in the Housing Authority and the Office of Economic Development, in terms of the way that they were thinking about what they needed to do to plan and prepare for redevelopment. And the action plans kind of helped us serve for a concrete foundation for planning for the work moving forward. Here's my contact information. All of the evidence-based practices, our meeting notes, our final reports, recommendations are available at this website in detail if you have any questions. The end. So I think we have time for questions about this presentation in particular, or any questions that didn't get answered about the other presentations. Yes. Yeah, we saw exactly the same thing. So the developers and the designers were really trying to start by talking about, do you want siding or brick? Where would you like the planters? You know, things like that. And they started there. They had all these visual designs that they want everybody to provide feedback on. And the residents are kind of like, well, is this happening? When is it going to happen? Am I going to be able to go? How will you decide? You know, how will I be prepared? What are the rules for relocation? They didn't know any of that stuff. And that's kind of really what we tried to do, is take a few steps back, because I think the developers were starting in the wrong place. And the residents were really not concerned about housing siding versus brick, or, you know, where the planter boxes were. They were really, really concerned about, am I going to be ready for this process, and what standards am I going to be held to? There were things, for example, like needing to keep your child's report card for the past 2 years looking at truancy issues, being accountable for certain volunteer standards, having your utility bills paid on time that nobody was talking about, but they were going to need to know when they got to the place where they had their interview to say, are you going to be able to move to this new great mixed income community that we want you to work to design? So a lot of it was kind of taking a step back and getting the developer and the designers to realize that they did not know the right place to start with the engagement process, and they really had to be responsive to the resident concerns in order to get any kind of engagement.
Do you have any suggestions if it has already been, if the developers have already engaged to the point of trying to design the features of the apartment, and is there a way that you can backtrack and start over?
Yes, so we told the developers they were not allowed to host meetings anymore. And that the residents themselves would host the meetings until resident engagement was sufficient, that people felt comfortable showing up in the space of dialogue. We did make sure that when they decided that they needed to hold a meeting, that residents were prepared in advance for what was going to happen at that meeting and how they could be engaged in the dialogue, but that they would show up knowing the issues that they wanted to have addressed and how they could have a voice in the process. So that was a lot of the leadership and advocacy training that we did with the residents. But the majority of the engagement that's going on now, the developer and the Office of Economic Development have taken a step back, and they're really not holding meetings like that at this time. Yes.
Thank you very much. I was curious about the trauma.
Yes. Sure. I think it's a really exciting model. It's out of the Hope SF redevelopment process. I think I have some information with me on it. If I can give you some more information, and the model is on our website under this URL. There's full information. It's really about kind of multi-stage engagement and setting some core values and core beliefs through the redevelopment process that all of the stakeholders engage, agree to do no harm, agree to have the impacted population engaging at the table throughout the process, that services are designed with that lens in mind, and that we really understand that the community, having been impacted by trauma, if they're not engaged and not involved in a way that they're feeling comfortable, it is a re-traumatizing process. So it's a pretty in-depth model. I don't have time to get into the full details of it, but it's exciting, and we really hope to be able to replicate it in Richmond. Mm-hmm. Yes?
How are they managing the relay procurement while they're doing the development? Are they trying to relay people to similar areas so they can feel like they have that community?
So that's a good question. One of the things that they really were not transparent about initially that we discovered through regularly engaging with the developer is that some residents will be relocated to a mixed income housing community with really nice amenities and sidewalks and parks and kind of lovely things. Only those that are currently in lease compliance and have been in lease compliance for about 2 years will be eligible for relocation into those communities, which is the minority of the population. So most of the individuals living in Creighton Court are out of compliance for one reason or another. A lot of them don't even know that they're out of compliance. So compliance is a really big issue that we're trying to figure out how to address. Those that are not in compliance will likely be moved to other subsidized housing or public housing developments. So we hope that they will not end up homeless or, otherwise in a bad situation. I didn't mention that often in public housing, in our public housing community, there's a lot of doubled up populations, people who are living informally on the lease, and that population was a big issue of concern, especially from the residents. Most of the service providers really know that it's happening too, but the developer wasn't aware. And so when we kind of brought that forward and said, well, when you think about relocating the population, are you thinking about relocating everybody who's there or only the people who are officially there? Because that's a small subset. So there have been some provisions in place to try to work with our supportive and affordable housing coalitions to make sure that people don't end up homeless, but it's a big issue of concern.
Were there any roadblocks with the developer once the discussion about supportive housing came up in terms of mental health accessibility to be incorporated to the development?
There really weren't roadblocks. I mean, I think that the biggest issue is just making sure that we can get enough funding for the permanent supportive housing. We found the developer to be extremely responsive to that concern. They do have an interest in the redevelopment relocation process being successful and in the population receiving the services that it needed. So I think that we found that as we brought the information and evidence towards the developer, that they were responsive, and immediately upon recognizing it, they committed to applying for funds. So I think that it's just a matter of that there are never enough permanent supportive housing units, and it's a huge issue in my community. And we know it's a huge issue for the population in subsidized housing in Richmond. It seems like everybody agrees on it, though, that they know it's an issue and they wish there was more funding.